What I'm trying to do in these three sessions is to give you the justification or the rationale or the analysis on the basis of which I am trying in our own local congregation in a very gentle, slow way to cause a revolution in the conception and the practice of the local church. And if I don't get at it today, certainly tomorrow, we'll discuss in some detail the kind of vision I have and the practice that we're engaged in trying to move in this direction in our own congregation. Broadly speaking, you could say that my thesis is that we are at the end of the Protestant era. And the fundamental principle of the Protestant era could be called the Protestant principle. Here I'm just following Paul Tillich in an early essay in the Protestant era, that the Protestant principle was a principle which established a great distance between God and life. And since there was such a great distance between God and life, such a great fall, such a sinful, such a perverted world, the principles on the basis of which the world could be organized were freedom or self-initiation and equality, and equality of self-initiation. And this led in the present, the last 400 years, to democracy or the giving of the vote to everyone and the initiation of everyone to laissez-faire economics and the giving of everyone the initiation of economics, permissiveness in education, and a kind of freedom to believe whatever you want in religion. Luther used to say, well, you've got to do your own believing as you do your own dying, but what you believe, he never said what you believe was simply a kind of individual matter. So that this freedom of self-initiation, regulated by equality of a sort, I mean, really not too much equality, of course, when you think of our relation to the rest of the world, but still it's a kind of regulative principle that functions more or less in our thinking about life. That fundamental way of looking at things has run its course. And we are in a period more or less like the early church, in which the other principle, the Catholic substance with a small c, the Catholic substance, love as a reality or a substance which informs the culture, which shapes the culture, which attempts to influence economics, politics, literature, music, art, everything. We are back in that period of the early church. Now the substance, so formally I'm saying, we are at the end of the Protestant principle and we are in a period when the Catholic substance, that means there has to be some vision. We cannot depend upon the interaction of self-initiations, which is the only principle. And Niebuhr, Reinhold Niebuhr, certainly resulted in that kind of a principle. You balance powers. You let forces interact, and somehow you believe out of that interaction the good will come. What has happened as a result of this kind of a view of things is that slowly, the Protestant principle never believed somehow that it was simply any self-initiation. It was initiation informed by some vision, by some Christian substance. But what has happened is that Christian substance has been leached out, as I said yesterday, and all of our institutions function without any vision informing them except that they are autonomous, self-law, self-initiation, and then we get the interactions. So that independence, freedom, fundamental view or the fundamental informing principle for the West, for our society. Now, there have been certain reactions against that in communism and fascism, understandably so, because that principle has simply not been able to function and break down. And yesterday I tried to indicate some of the aspects of our culture which indicated the growing breakdown, the malaise of our cities, and the inability of us to deal with inflation, and the inability of us to generalize or universalize our way of life for other people, indicate that there's something matter with what has sprung up out of this kind of a way of life. So that the next 200 years, then, we'll see a movement, as I was trying to say last night and yesterday, coming out of those Bible passages, a movement which says that there is no free kind of autonomous area of life. All are subject to some transcendent reality, to the givens, the destinies that you cannot transgress without paying the penalty of death and destruction. And that along with this kind of transcendent, holy, sacred view that everything has a relation to the ultimate will come a focus on what I call community, on the new Israel as a community of people, and that is to offset the individualism and the freedom simply to do what one wants. One will do whatever one wants in the context of a community of being and in relation to a community of being. So that, to put it another way, is to say that, take Tillich's ontology, for example, in his theology, and to say that if you could have a cube here and you could kind of diagram vertically the holy and the profane, and on the other axis you had the individualization, atomization, constant change of dynamics, and freedom of self-initiation, and on the other pole you had participation, form, and destiny, that we have moved way over towards secularization, profanation, individualization, freedom, change, dynamics, and we will move in the other direction inevitably. It's in the nature of being. There's no alternative. Everything okay?
Yes, okay. Caught the tip of it.
Yeah.
Or to forget the point. So, if this is so, and it's only my interpretation, and a lot of people wouldn't agree with it, of course. But one can't function without an interpretation. One simply just kind of, dances along lightly through life without an interpretation of where we are. And you don't have to have a fancy one, but you either have to have one in your mind or you have to act out of one, largely without self-consciousness, or else you kind of, fritter away your existence. And it's particularly true in times of change, when we're in crises, that you need this interpretation. I think we're really in a crisis in the West. I think this we're at the end of the modern period. We're at the end of the Protestant era. We're at the end of the real creative contribution of the principle of freedom as self-initiation. Now, let me say immediately that this is dialectical, and so we could be just as demonic if we move completely in another direction without continually taking into account the dialectic. But for the sake of life, at this point in history, we simply have to move and experiment with moving, and sometimes you think that the reality that we have constituted for ourselves is so strong, so ingrained in us, so biological in us, as Marcuse would say, of this way of being that is ours, that it's almost impossible to dislodge. And maybe you have to wait for new generations and for some catastrophes to either wipe a lot of us out or to wipe a lot of the reality we have out, so we have to, in other words, it's almost impossible to get our minds around what this all means, because we have been educated through all of our universities and all of our schooling to believe and to function out of an orientation which I think is very demonic and idolatrous. Demonic and idolatrous because it's focused on one aspect of being, very creative, but alone demonic. It isn't that it's wrong, it isn't that it's absolutely destructive, it's just destructive if it's lifted up and made absolute. And that's what we've done with freedom, with independence, and with kind of letting the historical move along without reference to the holy, without reference to being, what I was trying to say last night, without reference to the reality that brings life and is available, which I feel has been covered over. And the whole conditioning of our subjectivity and our reality is such that we can't even feel it. We can't experience this kind of a world that the Bible is talking about. Now, today I want to talk a little about the church in this context. What I've said thus far is what's happened the last 200 years or 2,000 years or 400 years, 400 years actually, if you think of it as the Protestant era, and where we're going to move, the general direction that we're going to move. And the actual content of that, nobody knows. That is, what that's going to mean institutionally, nobody knows. So it's, there isn't a kind of formula. There's only a general direction available. Now, what about the church? I think that the church in the next 200 years will move from an emphasis, well, on what I call the eschatology, or eschatological emphasis, which I take to mean a kind of emphasis on the transcendent, to an emphasis on history. Actually, the church, as it's developed recently, certainly, has more and more ignored history. The church of the early period had a kind of dialectic between the eschatological and the historical. Actually, some people think that Paul had only the eschatological dimension, but certainly the church, as the Roman church developed. And incidentally, I think the Reformation in some respects was a mistake. It had to happen, but it was a mistake. That is to say, the church, which was trying to inform the culture, is the church we have to return to, which is the Catholic kind of way of looking at things. And in order for the Catholic Church to come to itself, it was necessary. It wasn't absolutely necessary, but historically it resulted in the split. But we have to go back to that Catholic principle and the Catholic substance and try to inform the culture. And the worldwide institution that the Catholic Church is, if it could function with a certain kind of vision, is a great instrument for the bringing about of some changes. So that it's kind of futile, in my estimation, to get hung up on whether the Protestants or the Catholics have the key to the kingdom or all that kind of thing. It seems to me that what's been involved in Catholicism and in Protestantism somehow has to be brought together. But in our period, the church has to move from what it's been as a kind of Catholic church to a sect. Now, that may actually mean a new reformation. And we may get another break and a new formation. In other words, there may be a break within Protestantism and Catholicism. And not that I would ever set out or predict that or think it's good if it can be avoided. But if the church has to move in the direction of countercultural force in the next period, and then an alternative cultural vision at some point, then it's really going to fight forces that have embodied themselves in the church, which are so conditioned by and so dependent upon the present cultural reality that it will be like the Grand Inquisitor. That is, the forces, the creative forces, the Christ coming back to earth in the form of an alternative culture will be put in prison and burned. And it may be that there'll be churches in catacombs and all kinds of places trying to embody an alternative culture. Because as I see it, the only hope for our culture, the only institution that has the possibility for creativity is the church. You look at all the other institutions, and the church isn't much in the way of a resource. But it's all we have. As Tillich used to say, it's our greatest glory and our greatest shame. And you've got to continually remember that it has the seed of the possibility of really becoming a redemptive force. And what we're trying to do, in the words of one former teacher at Yale Divinity School, who's now in our community for a while, I don't know whether he'll stay in it, but he's been at everything we've done for the last 6 or 7 weeks. What we're trying to create in the church is a redemptive community. And if you take the position I have, a redemptive community has to begin to embody a new way of being. A new way of being. And that means a new way of being in relation to everything. There isn't any place in our society where the idols don't dominate, and where you aren't forced into all kinds of destructive decisions. Forced, I say, where you aren't encouraged, where it isn't impressed upon you. You know, we are all free, but so there's nothing which is really forced upon us, but certainly everything moves in that direction. It's very difficult. So then, as I've said already, the change from eschatology to history, again, it's dialectical always. From a church to a sect, again, it's dialectical because there are aspects of both that we'll need. And eventually, the sect will become the church. In other words, the sect, which is countercultural, and then alternative culture, will, if it's effective, become the instrument for the whole culture changing. And if the culture changes, then we'll have a church somewhat like ours today, which doesn't have to take into account its role in the whole culture, or you might say the way the church has been in certain periods, because it kind of depends upon the culture to embody the good, and it doesn't have to create itself. But in our period, it seems to me that there's no alternative but for the church to be countercultural and very cautiously alternative culture, because it simply has to emerge. It's not something anybody's vision or anybody's... you can't make it, shape it. And that's the problem with some of the socialist alternatives, is that somebody thinks he can make and shape a new world by simply putting some people up on top planning it. But somehow it has to emerge, I think, out of new churches, which are oases of new life, and there's a silent revolution that will occur, and eventually that'll result in a political program and a politics and an economics and education which will be quite different from our present system. Well, that's kind of where I am.
Yeah, and do a little more on new church. Do you mean institutionally, or new structure within, or both, or?
Well, what we're trying to do in our church is to establish a covenantal community within the church. And it's difficult. But so that you will maintain yourself as a part of the institution, but you will attempt to move in a somewhat different direction without cutting yourself off. Whether that's possible or not, I don't know, but that's the intent. And so we're trying to buy an apartment building, and we want to get the church to buy the apartment building so that we can have housing. Now, housing is just a step, kind of housing where our people can live together in an apartment building and begin to do the things for each other that you can do if you're living together, and to have the kind of life that you can have and the relations that you can have. It's kind of an extended family, tribe, and you know, so it's within the local congregation. If it doesn't work that way, it'll have to work some other way. But the idea is to become a model, and that's not too impressive. The idea is to find a way of doing it. Hopefully, in my own mind, I think about something that other congregations could do, and then everybody says, your congregation is different, couldn't happen in ours. And most of the time, I don't think it can happen in mine.
How do people join this segment? How open are you to people? Do people come and say, we want to join you, and do you accept them, or are there...
Well, how open are we? We're very fuzzy right now because... It's a nurture, a growth, and we haven't written our covenant yet. The covenant is kind of not expressed, although we had several sessions on the principles of the covenant and what we think will go in the covenant. And when we get our building and people begin to want to come in, we say, well, you come in if you kind of agree to our covenant, then we'll have to have a covenant, you know, when we get the thing going. Well, how does any committee, how does a religious education committee, how
it's
does...
It's a little different, though, because if you're a group that's...
Yeah, I know. It's going to cause some problems. I can't tell you how it's going to work, because I don't know. And I know some communities like this have split off from their churches. It's my intention to turn heaven and earth to remain a real part. So it'll be the covenantal community of University Church. Forever. But you know, forever. I mean, God has his ways.
So that's in Chicago.
Yeah, I think it has to take place in the cities. That's where the people are. I mean, that's why it's in the city. I prefer to live out in the small community. That's where I prefer to live. But it seems to me that if it can happen there in the city, then it can happen other places. And more difficult, probably. I don't know whether it's difficult. I think that's what God calls me to do, is to go. That's all I can say. Calls me to go where I've spent my life in the city of Chicago and try to do something which is a little different from all the things Joe and I have been trying to do in cities for a long time. You mean, what have people found desirable, or what have they done to withdraw from the culture? Kind of? Is that what you're asking the group to brainstorm on?
You know, how does one go through their own life and be conscious of not perpetuating those things that are not good, and have some sort of an anti-culture thing that the gospel might call us to be?
You know, where I find it, and sometimes it seems silly, but, you know, when you go ahead and you buy a smaller car, or you look at your closet and say, there's no reason in heaven that I need 35 shirts, and yet they're there, because they're available, or you give your gifts in a joyful, sacramental way. It's not, well, I gave 10%, Lord, you know, now that's it. That's all those little things that if you sit back, you almost have a tendency to laugh at yourself doing. And yet I think that's finally where as individuals I have to make my start and then try to share that with other people. And it's very frustrating because you're fighting the whole cultural thing that people that you work with in the congregation generally don't want to change. Because they're really playing the game institutionally and in their lifestyle. And for you to come in the church then and call them away from that can be really a jolting thing, depending on the congregation you're in. And the richer the congregation or wealthier lifestyle has, the harder it is to do that because they're making it. And they're not looking over their shoulder quite as much as somebody else. And it's really hard in a traditional parish, in a successful area, to do what you are concerned about. And yet you see some people that share those concerns.
Well, you know, it's hard in our congregation. One woman said, well, why don't we move people into condominiums? And she's got, there were two or three empty in her building, and the cheapest one was $52,000, and that's 9%. You figure 10% for your investment, 8% what you could get for the money already, 10% for your mortgage, it's $4,500 before you start. I said, well, you're going to eliminate 90% of our congregation before you begin, if that's where you're going to form your community. So first principle is open, you know, everybody. So it's... Well, I think there's no royal road. I think two or three people gathered together just begin to think about what this all means and what it means personally and then what it means as a group to begin to have a somewhat different lifestyle, talk about it. And there's some books, the book reread here at Holden a couple of years ago, spent a week on it, and people really read the book. And was the Joyful Community, the story of the Bruderhof. That's a very extreme community, living off by themselves, completely segregated, except their high school students go to regular high schools and their young people go to college, but the rest of their life is completely isolated from the world, from the general world. That's not my way of doing things, because I believe more that the pattern that the Church of Our Savior in Washington, where there's mission, they got, told me, 5,000 people in mission. 92 members of the church and 5,000 people joined informally in mission with them. And so it's, but there just isn't any formula. I think you're right, you can begin to do some things as an individual, but I think unless you have a community, it can't sustain itself over a long period of time. And eventually people say, well, what are we going to do about education since we're in an area where education is a problem? I say, well, I have our own one-room schoolhouse. Probably more education will occur there than occurs other places. You know, there's all kinds of ways of meeting all these issues that the what I call the if, ands, and buts of people who find difficulty in moving in this way. The real issue, I think, is whether we agree with the cultural analysis. If we agree with the cultural analysis, other is a problem, but it's... I don't know whether we agree with my cultural analysis enough so that there's a real push to try an alternative.
Is part of what you're doing part style and the community concept? And then part change as far as direction, would that be fair to say there's those two elements?
Style, I'm not sure what you mean.
Style of living, like the coming together in community. I served in a rural parish and I saw that that parish had a lot going for it that the suburban ones I've served haven't had. And that at least the people bumped into each other in the market.
Yeah.
You know, I couldn't go through town without getting honked at. Waved at, and not for doing anything wrong, just because other people, you know, that you see. So I hear you saying that part, but then also a redirection.
Yeah, there is the sense in which what we're trying to do is just bring people together so that they're together enough so that they can know each other and know each other enough so they can care for each other. Very simple kinds of things. Taking meals to people, or meeting somebody at the airport, or doing all kinds of little things, but of course, as soon as you begin to try to do those things, then you got to have some people who are free to do them. And then they can't be so involved in the culture and in their jobs and roles. I mean, I can do a lot of that stuff because I'm now retired, so I got a kind of freedom. There are a lot of other people with free time but don't have the inclination. So how you get... But I think it's... Some people should retire. I once preached a sermon here that you ought to retire, begin to retire when you're born from the American culture. But how can you do that? Then you've got to reshape your whole life and your expectations of how you carry your mortgages and the kids' college educations and all the things that... And so the community is being designed with a view to reducing the pressures, whether it will or not, I don't know, because you're part of a whole culture. The thing that impressed me, and I wrote a little on it, if I can find it, about the Bruderhof was that Benjamin Zablocki, who did the study, said it was the most joyful place he'd ever been in his life. And he'd been around, study communities, been to 100 places. It was sheer joy. That was very attractive to me. And it's one of the things that attracts me is, I guess, the sense that it's just too difficult to live a joyful life.
Where is that? This Bruderhof location? In New York? I'm just curious.
There's some in New York, some in Connecticut, one in Pennsylvania. Three different locations.
How the children tend to return because they go away to school?
They tend to return, according to the study. Most of the young people had returned.
How are we going to keep them thinking alike in a community?
How would you keep them thinking alike? Yeah.
Thinking alike?
That doesn't seem to be a problem yet in our community. Our minister and his wife are in a collective, and they said it took them 3 years in order to kind of agree on what kind of meals to serve. So I'm not worried about thinking alike. What I'm concerned about is to get enough sense of ultimacy and the meaning of what we're doing that it gives an impetus for doing the things that are required if this new way is to emerge. Because we all have our programs, and I remember the first time we got together, I suggested we meet once a week. I suggested we meet for the next 4 Sunday evenings. And that blew people's minds. That they would covenant together to spend that much time together in the light of their schedules. And they would really be committed to spending that. So now we meet every other Sunday for a potluck supper and do something, and it's kind of a family affair. It's slowly beginning. It's very, very fragile and tentative. I'm convinced, and a few other people are convinced, that this is the direction we have to move. We don't know how to move in this direction. So what we have is a direction. That's about all I have. It's a general direction. We have to withdraw from the culture, generally. Not always. I mean, there may be some people who ought to spend more time in some institutions that are now existing. But generally withdraw, be free, reduce the realm of necessity so you can exist with some joy without having a lot of the things that we think we have to have. So then you get the freedom. At least you can do what you want. If you don't have to have all those things, then you're not committed to having to earn all the money and stay in a certain position. You have a kind of abandon, a kind of freedom, and...
Is this a matter of evolution, this of community?
Well, sure, it's a matter of evolution, in the sense it's a revolution, but what's the difference? It's just a matter of... I think it probably happened by evolution, although there will be in our culture, I predict, because of the inability of our present system to function, revolutions which move toward socialism. That is to say, they move toward the imposition of standards and of ways of being from the top. And because the system isn't working. I mean, it's clear, as Jürgen Habermas, one of the foremost German philosophers, says, that the system of the interaction of self-initiations hasn't worked in the economy. What are you left with is an economy which only a few people know anything enough about to do anything about. And so you're in the hands of elites then. And we've just got a system which is broken down, and nobody, you know, the ordinary citizen, if you depend upon the ordinary citizen to decide what to do about inflation, what do we do, you know? And so you then turn it over to elites, and so we are going to be in a very revolutionary situation in order to deal with some of these. Friedman, a very conservative economist, predicts what? He says if we grow, we'll have from 15% to 20% inflation by the time of the next election, and if we don't grow, we'll have from 10% to 15% inflation. What do you think of what that does to the whole lifestyle? Now we're in a lot of turbulence, I think, and we're in for a lot of turbulence, and there'll be all kinds of solutions and so forth. And my solution doesn't in this direction for the church doesn't really handle a lot of those systemic problems. That's what all my old friends say. You've sold out to a kind of privatized, small approach. And I don't know what else to do. I think Joe may have some ideas on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday about how to deal with the whole system, I hope. And they're going to come and listen. But
I'm sort of bursting to say that when John Yoder was here, John Yoder is a member of the Mennonite Church and spoke to us as a minority. And that there are a lot of tapes of his. And he was referring to a preface that Luther wrote to the German Mass, where he said he wanted to keep the Latin Mass for the intellectuals, he wanted the German Mass for everybody. And then he foresaw a house church type thing where people who wanted to be Christians in earnest would come together. And he used Matthew 18:15, if your brother sins against you, go and tell him his fault, using this house church as a means of reconciliation, and spoke about that, and also spoke about the free church, the tradition of the free church, which has always been away from the mainline Episcopalian Protestant, which has tried to take this radical sort of...
Yeah, well, he's definitely a sectarian, and the Mennonites have always been where you have you have self-conscious faith. You're not born into the church. You have to make a conscious decision as a very disciplined, ordered way that you have to kind of agree to. And so he and I would tend to agree. He would say that universally, and I'd say it historically. In other words, I'd say our history demands this, but it doesn't necessarily demand it for all history. And I think he would say that this is what... No, it will always be true.
He was pointing to different options that you had as a Christian, and pointed to the legitimacy of withdrawing and forming a community which provided an example, a kind of pilot project which would work on a small scale and therefore was a means of proclaiming.
So what you're saying is these things kind of coincide, he's saying.
And maybe if some people want to listen to some of the tapes, it's different. I mean, we haven't had a person like him up there, I don't think.
Yeah, all I was saying, what he believes in general, I believe in particular, for a particular historical situation. Because he's the kind of person who wouldn't think, I believe at least, that you'd ever get a cultural situation in which the Christian faith could find its embodiment more or less, never find it, but find it more than it is today, whereas I have a kind of view that some periods of history the Christian substance is embodied more than others, and that you don't have to be countercultural in principle. You know, it's called the Christ against culture in principle, and I'm a Christ, the transformer of culture, or Christ is providing a series of cultures as embodiments, or that culture is the substance of religion, or the form of religion, and religion is the substance of culture, to use Tillich's phrase. Never know what it means, but it kind of sounds good. And it's kind of, you know, it's kind of interesting, because it really means that you don't have a religion unless you have a culture. And so I have a hard time withdrawing except for the sake of the whole. and a withdrawal which doesn't have as its purpose, mission, and have as part of its constant life. One of our principles is that everybody in our community will be, hopefully, encouraged, not forced, to attend to something in the culture, some sphere of the culture, for the sake of Christ. That is, some economics, some to nursing or health, and you know, all these kinds of things. And to be involved in some way in the institutions, or be establishing counter-institutions, but always for the sake of, not because somehow, if you're a Christian, your life can be seen as apart from its relatedness to the whole. In other words, I really believe what Paul says in Corinthians, in Romans, 1 Corinthians 12 and following, that we are parts of each other. And what happens to anybody in South Africa, to use Joe's recent stamping ground, happens to me. And therefore, if I withdraw, it is with a great sense of the ambiguity of it. If I withdraw simply for my own sake, because it gives me a kind of security and a kind of new life, if it isn't for the sake of the whole, then I'd be very unhappy. And I don't know whether that fits in with the others or not. If it does, it does. If it doesn't, it doesn't.
are you saying then that the withdrawal into community is to find the source and the strength to go back out into the culture to transform?
Well, yeah, but you may not go back out right away because you may be in a situation. In other words, some people say, well, you sound like you're in the period of the monastery, and it may well be that we go through some trials and turbulences where some things have to preserve. You know, I don't have any kind of formula because I can't see what's going to happen in history. I can only predict the general direction, like the prophets. You know, they say, well, this is what's going to happen, and that's the way I feel. This is what's going to happen because this is what God is like and what His world is like. And therefore, you move in a general direction, and together, keep trying to formulate and think about what it means for each person individually in the community. Now, it's one great big task to try to find roles for people that bring income. Campus Church in Minneapolis has 80 people working in its what it's called fish industries. And I've talked to some people here who don't know what to do with their existence. And one of the problems we have is to find roles for people and ways of supporting people and doing things the community thinks are important. So some people will be supporting other people. And other people will be out there maybe in a job that they don't like too well, earning $80,000 a year, so they can feed it into the community. Now, the reason I was in the Freedom Movement and was a business agent for 40 black contractors, I wanted to get $1 million a year take with $100 million a year contracting for the Freedom Movement. That's why I was in contract. I wasn't in contracting to develop a lot of contracts, although that was important in a way, but it was to get the take. And I spent a lot of time trying to get that money so we could do a lot of other things that we needed to do. And there may be some, you know, some of us may have to do some of the things because we have the talents and we have the locations. But it makes all the difference in the world why you do what you do and how you relate what you do to the church. You know, I think right now that the church is the only hope, and that the church has to begin to formulate this new way of being and the meaning of this new way of being for economics and politics and everything. And so I guess I think if you're in a job or you got an industry, the thing to do is begin to ask, how can I use that position in this culture, which is so ambiguous and so demonic in many ways, to help and nurture the growth of something better? So it doesn't mean you'd withdraw. You know, I didn't withdraw from University of Chicago. I milked that place in a sense. They paid my salary for years while I did all kinds of things other places. And it gave me the freedom. I was one of the most free people in the city of Chicago because I had, as you well know, I mean, I didn't need to worry about the income if I just did 20, 25 hours a week work. Either 9 months or 6 months. If I got a quarter off, then I used a quarter off. You know, I was supposed to do research or something. Well, I didn't do it. I I was what you call an, what do you call it, a participant observer? I was observer participant. I got all those files, all those records. I could write them up if I didn't think it was more important to build the community. You know, I could write some great manuscript on the freedom of God. I got more of the records than anybody else in the city. You could do some great research project. I don't destroy them. I mean, I still keep that possibility, but I doubt whether I'll ever do it as long as this community is going, because it just seems more important to do that. I don't mean to focus this on me. I only focus it on me because you've got to focus it on you and where you are and what you're called to be, and you're not where I am, and you don't have the freedoms, and you don't have the, you've got to start where you are.
So you spoke a little while ago about the country would be in the hands of elite. Who are those elites?
The best and the brightest. David Halberstam's book.
But can I be one?
Well, probably not. I mean, you got to have power. You've got to be a part of the military. You've got to be a part of the government, or you got to be a part of industry, or you got to be a part, you know, a big industry. You got to be a part of the unions. Where you've got the money. I mean, little illustration when they were dealing with the gas deregulation, the American Gas Institute allowed $500,000 for it, and they fed into a computer all the answers, pro and con, to anything that they thought might be proposed. And when the people, you know, the committee members would walk out of the committee meeting, they get the handouts, the printouts from the computer with their arguments for it. I mean, that's, if you're an elitist, if you got that kind of money and that kind of power and that kind of technology at your beck and call. I mean, in terms of the present power situation.
It doesn't mean the elite would be political, then.
Well, they certainly are political. Because I don't know any elite that aren't political. I mean, what do the researchers do, the elite in our universities? How are the universities supported? They're supported by research grants, mostly from the government, which means that they're playing politics all the time in terms of getting money. I mean, the University of Chicago gets millions and millions of dollars from corporations and from government agencies in order to support the institution, and every other great university does. So we become very political. Actually, we may have to become political in order to get our project off the ground. Well, I mean, the city is going to give us up to $200,000 matching to rehab the place. May give it, you know, if we meet all the conditions. Well, you've got to meet those conditions. So you've got to be wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Someone want to deal with the whole shebang here now. What's your reaction? Must be some people who think this is all kind of
I think you're getting crazy. Away from a situation where you don't have no
crazy.
I mean, even your community, do you think it might get big enough that there's going to be
I'm not saying, I'm not against elites. It's a question of the character of the elite.
Will that change, or has the character of the elite pretty much stayed the same?
Well, I think the character of the elite. It's what the vision is, what the goals are, what the humanity is that's involved in someone who's in a position of power.
The constant continuing reforming that'll go on within.
I am not a kind of a simple Democrat who believes somehow if you got consensus, you got everybody participating, you'd get a great revolution. I don't think you would. So I am for elites, but the question is, what's the character of the elite?
Morality and the openness.
What do the elites want? What are they after? What do they think it means to be human? And then what are they doing about it? How do they do it? So that it's clear, all of the communities that have succeeded have been built around strong individuals, what are called charismatic figures. I don't think I'm a particularly charismatic figure. So maybe our community won't succeed, but we now have a kind of six or seven people who are functioning in leadership roles.
How large is your community?
Oh, nobody knows. There are seven people, I think, that you could count to stick together and whose commitment is extraordinary. What's any church? If you ask, if
you ask any, you know, if you ask church people to do certain things, say to tithe 25% of their salary, how many people would be in the community? So if I asked people to move into this area, which is mostly all black, and that somehow moving in is part of being in the community, which I don't, because you can belong to the community and not move in, and then the question is, how many people would move in? Well, some won't move in because it's not the right school district, because not the right people, because it's not as safe as other areas, because they can't get a capital gains tax if they sell their condominium. You know, got all the ifs, ands, and buts. So who's in the community? It's like saying, who is really faithful in the church? I won't know until 10 years from now who's in and who's out, and even then there'll be people in a whole continuum of relationship to it. Well, I think it's time to go for coffee.